Today is Tuesday, November 28th. We're going to work on reproductive system physiology today. Okay, so pages 126 and 127. We'll start with male reproductive anatomy first. You know, the goal of the reproductive systems is to produce sex cells, which are also known as gametes. Male sex cells are known as sperm, and of course, female sex cells are known as eggs or ova. So in order to produce sperm, we are looking at organs called testes. There's a pair hanging outside the body in a scrotum sac. And we're looking at a set of tubing or ductwork that carries those sperm to the exterior of the male body. So we'll start off by looking at the testes first. These glands tend to mature around puberty. And for a male, that runs somewhere from like age 10 to 14. Males do tend to mature a little later than females do in terms of puberty years. So at puberty, those testes start to produce sperm. And when does sperm production stop?
Never.
Exactly. So it's a lifelong process starting at puberty. You may think back to endocrine. This is a great time for us to review endocrine materials. There are some hormones made by the hypothalamus called gonadotropic releasing hormones, or GnRH for short. What do those hormones tell your anterior pituitary to secrete?
FSH and LH.
Good, FSH and LH, good. So even in males, FSH and LH is made, and follicle stimulating hormone and luteinizing hormone then target the testes. One of those hormones encourages testosterone production, the other hormone encourages sperm production. And so of course to make sperm, you're gonna need the testosterone levels to increase sperm production. When sperm are matured, they are matured here in the epididymis. That's the top portion of the testis. And when ejaculation occurs, they are ejaculated through peristalsis ways from the epididymis up through this vas or ductus deferens. It wraps into the body and around the bladder. We now start picking up fluids from this gland on the back side of the bladder, and it's called the seminal vesicles. And it makes about 60 or 70% of the fluids that are found in semen. From there, the sperm travel through the prostate, this apple-shaped gland. There's a tube that passes through the prostate. That one is called what?
The ejaculatory duct.
And so we now pick up more fluids from the prostate. Those fluids help to activate sperm, nourish the sperm. And from that point, you'll notice that we're joining with the urethra, which travels off the base of the bladder. Mm-hmm. Now, in order for sperm to travel in a more cleansed tube, there's a Cowper's or bulbourethral gland that secretes a clear mucus secretion into the urethra prior to ejaculation. And so that gland sitting right there is the Cowper's or bulbourethral gland, and it should cleanse acid urine out of the urethra prior to the passage of semen. So we know that semen tends to run on the basic or alkaline side of the pH scale. Urine tends to run on the more acidic side. So acids do tend to kill sperm, and they'll have plenty of chances to get killed once they enter the female's reproductive tract anyway. No sense in killing them before they even get out of the stall. So that's what that bulbourethral gland is there for, is to help cleanse that urethra. So that, in effect, is the pathway of sperm from the testes to the exterior of the body. We know that that urethra actually has three main regions. There's a prostatic urethra that runs through the prostate. There's a membranous urethra, and the last one?
Spongy
urethra, good. And so whoever said that men don't have PMS didn't study the urethra, right? Prostatic, membranous, and spongy, okay? So there is a sphincter that prevents the passage of both urine and semen at the same time. That sphincter is kind of like a valve that prevents both fluids from being carried down the urethra simultaneously. Okay, so inside the testis, there are tiny little tubules called seminiferous tubules, and that's kind of the birthplace of sperm. We're going to talk today about making sperm, and the process is going to take around 10 weeks to mature a sperm from its birthplace in these seminiferous tubules until they're being able to ejaculate from the male's body. This portion here that sits on top of the testis, called the epididymis, those sperm spend about, say, 20 days there being matured, and it's during that time that they lose extra cytoplasm and become streamlined. All right. So a lot of tubing there to travel through. moment. Let me get you a little further along. We'll talk here. This is a little bit about those gland secretions. They're found on page 127. Okay, so we know that semen is a collection of not only fluids but also sperm. These fluids help to nourish the sperm, allow them to be transported in a fluid medium. They survive for about 48 to 72 hours once inside a female's reproductive tract. Young sperm can swim fairly fast. You're looking at about 45 minutes to reach an egg once inside a female's reproductive tract. But older sperm are a little bit slower. It takes them around 2.5 days to get to the sperm once inside the female's reproductive tract. So, you know, you're thinking about somebody like Hugh Hefner who had kids once he was in his 80s. You know, he must have had some great timing for sperm to actually reach an egg. Eggs only live about a day, so you can see that the timing really has to work there in order for fertilization to occur.
So what is considered old?
Probably 50s, 60s. The older you get, the slower those sperm are going to travel. So probably 60s and up. So semen is a combination of fluids from the seminal vesicles. That contains a yellowish fluid that activates sperm. Prostate gland also contains some activators. That is a milky, sugary secretion. There's some fructose in those prostate secretions that help to nourish the sperm for their 2 to 3 day trip. And then finally, we've talked about the Cowper's gland or bulbourethral gland. It's going to secrete clear mucus. That's going to cleanse the urethra, and that's really its primary function. So the two main components of semen come from those seminal vesicle secretions and the prostate secretions, and of course the sperm mixed in. When they're ejaculated, they're not necessarily switched on to swim, and so there's an activation that occurs that says, okay, you've been shot out, you swim. So it's called capacitation, and it basically allows for them to start swimming. Otherwise, they're just kind of immobile. They're just hanging out, yeah. Yep. You've arrived.
Yeah,
swim. So just a little bit about prostate gland issues. You know, males can have prostate swelling around that urethra and ejaculatory duct. And you can see that in this picture here on the right, that swelling can obstruct the flow of not only urine from the urethra from the bladder, but also what else can that swollen prostate obstruct?
Ejaculatory duct,
yeah. So there's two tubes there that can be impaired if you have a swollen prostate. So there is something called benign prostatic enlargement, BPE, and then there's also cancerous prostatic problems too. So, you know, there's a blood test that can be performed to determine if there's actually a need for further investigation into the prostate. So what I'd like to do is take you today into a little bit of meiosis. This is something you may not have heard of before. And it begins on page 129. Some of you guys have had mitosis back in Bio 210, but I'm not sure if meiosis has been part of your background before. Have you heard of meiosis before?
In high school.
At high school, okay. That may have been the most recent time for, I guess, most people. Mm-hmm. Do you know what meiosis makes?
Gametes.
Yep, sex cells or gametes, right. Good.
They're haploid,
not diploid, that's right. So I wanted to make sure that we were having the same conversation by laying some foundation here with terminology. So let's start by talking about the terms here, diploid and haploid. So most of your body cells are diploid. That means they have two sets of chromosomes.
What page did you say it was on?
This is on the top of page 129, but this is background info. I didn't know if you had this or not.
No.
Okay. So I didn't put this in the course pack, but I just want to make sure we were talking the same language here. Well, it's involved in the next page of conversation, so this page and the next page, so having this background is going to be helpful. So diploid means that there's two sets of chromosomes. You know, when we're talking about body cells, like skin cells, for instance, we're looking at a diploid set of chromosomes. Diploid means that you have 46 total chromosomes in your cells. Hap sounds like half. So what is half of 46? 23. Good. So why should a sperm only have 23 chromosomes and not the total of 46?
It's going to combine with the 23 and the egg of female.
Yep. Female's egg should have 23. The male sperm should have 23. They should be haploid cells because the ultimate goal is to make a new individual with 46 total chromosomes. Okay, so 46 is diploid, 23 chromosomes is haploid. I'm going to get a cheat sheet over here. Let me grab the lights for y'all.
I was in here yesterday. It was terrible.
It's just hot. It's like I had hopes it would not be so hot.
When you come in from the outside where it's cold, you come in fully dressed, and now it's hot.
Yeah. You can't win, you know? Di means two, diploid chromosome counts are 46, and you'll notice I put two N up there. That's because it's double, or two sets of chromosomes. Hap, or half, you know, haploid chromosome counts, there's about 23 chromosomes, so we're just going to call that one N, or 23 chromosomes. So what we say are haploid in our bodies are sex cells, gametes like egg and sperm. Everything else is supposed to be a diploid cell. From Bio210, do you remember the difference between a chromosome and a chromatid? Heard the terms before? Okay. So let's see. Chromosomes can have two arms on top and two arms on the bottom. This is what we call a double-stranded chromosome. Chromosomes can also have single strands, meaning that they have one arm on top and one arm on the bottom. So these arms that I'm talking about, they're chromatids. So on this one, the double-stranded chromosome, there's two chromatids, one on each, you know, top piece there. There's also two chromatids here on the bottom, but by contrast, a single-stranded chromosome only has one arm or chromatid on top and one arm or chromatid on the bottom. So arm and chromatid, I'm using those two terms here interchangeably. So part of our conversation is to understand that when cells undergo division, we actually have to separate those chromatids from one another. We're going to eventually get them down to a point of being single-stranded, and they're going to be haploid in those sex cells. So that actually takes care of our next step there. Our next topic is double versus single-stranded chromosomes. Double-strandeds have two chromatids on top and bottom. Single-strandeds only have one chromatid on the top and the bottom. Now, the confusing thing is, these are both called chromosomes, even though they look totally different. What makes them different, though, is the fact that the double-stranded has an X appearance and the single-stranded chromosome looks like a single airplane propeller. Okay. And then finally, the term homologous chromosome. Let's break that word down. Homologous, or homo, means same. So we have 23 pairs of chromosomes, And when we undergo meiosis, those 23 pairs partner up with their matching chromosomes. So we have a set of chromosomes number 1 through 23. During meiosis, those pairs are going to get together with number 1 with number 1, set number 2 partners up, and so forth. So it's like having a set of twins. They partner up during meiosis, and then they undergo cell division from that standpoint. So homologous chromosomes are pairs. Okay, and so 1 through 23 are going to be partnered up. You'll notice that they look the same, and that's because they're the same chromosome.
So when someone has Down syndrome, both parents have to get an extra chromosome?
Actually, just one. Mm-hmm. When they're looking at pair number 21, they'll have that. So instead of just a homologous pair, you've actually got what's called trisomy, mm-hmm. or a third pair. Yeah, so anytime somebody has extra chromosomes, they may have one of these, you know, extra. They may actually be missing arms or parts or in total a chromosome. Some chromosome abnormalities are fatal. You know, the baby would never even be born. And then in other cases, you know, we can survive with missing or extra chromosomes. Do you feel okay with these terms before we move forward? Any questions, anything I can clarify for you? So I know you've had mitosis before. I just want to give you something familiar to hang on to. In terms of mitosis, when we did this in Bio210, our goal was to make a set of cells that were identical to the parent cell. Okay, so we looked at one cell division when we did mitosis. We ended up making cells that were genetic clones of the parent cell. So those clone cells had the same number of chromosomes as the parents. We're not going to do that here with meiosis. In fact, we're going to take that chromosome count, pare it down by half. In order to strip down the excess DNA, we actually have to undergo two cell divisions, and that way we can actually get a low enough chromosome count in order to have 23 chromosomes in an egg and, of course, 23 in a sperm. Just pausing here in case anybody needs a picture. Or anyone still need the slide? So what I'd like to do is show you both sperm and egg production. We'll take sperm production first, and we're going to cover the picture on the bottom of page 129. Now, I want you to see that sperm and egg production pretty much follow the same pattern, so it's not like they're two totally different processes, but they routinely follow mitosis first, and then they undergo the two separate divisions of meiosis. So that's just what we're going to watch here is mitosis, meiosis, and then we're going to mature those cells in order for them to be fertilized. So why don't we start with cells in the testes? We know that sperm are made in the retestis area of the testes. And this process of making sperm begins at around puberty and happens to occur until death occurs. So we're looking at a lifelong process starting at puberty, making these sperm. We're going to start with a diploid cell. Just to save space here, I'm going to use 2N to represent diploid. And these diploid cells are going to be the ones that undergo mitosis to produce another set of cells. Now, since these cells are undergoing mitosis, are they identical or are they genetically different from the parent cell? They're identical. Good. Thank you. mitosis makes two cells, right? Both cells being genetically identical to the parent cell. And you're noticing that we're only following one of those cells down the stem cell line. The other cell is going to be returned back up here to the stem cell line so it can continue to process. If you ran through all of your stem cells or spermatogonia, you would have none others to continue to process. So we're actually going to return one of these back, let it run the process continually. We're going to follow this cell here through its process of making a sperm, and under the process of mitosis, we're going to watch us create a primary spermatocyte. So we'll label this one here as a primary. Okay, that one's called a primary spermatocyte. And in this picture, it's the very top cell for that sperm line. Game plan here is to undergo mitosis and then two divisions of meiosis. Meiosis one occurs, and meiosis two must then occur. And this is a goal for us to create cells that have the right number of DNA. So what are we looking for? Are we looking for sperm that have haploid or diploid sets of DNA?
Haploid.
Good. So let's just make that our goal down here. These are the four sperm that we're going to create. All right, so what we're going to do is take a primary spermatocyte. We're going to let it partner up with its homologous chromosomes. And they're going to line up on the metaphase plate and actually be separated from their homologs. That will allow us to send 23 double-stranded chromosomes to each of these cells. Because we have reduced them down to 23, does that mean that we're now diploid or haploid?
Haploid.
We're haploid. Good. So we're just going to write one N there, or N. Okay. And we still actually have extra DNA. Because we have double-stranded chromosomes, we actually need to separate them into single-stranded chromosomes. So we'll go through one more division process, meiosis two, and that will help us bring us from a double-stranded haploid state down to a single-stranded haploid state, something that looks like that. So big process here. This takes about 10 weeks or so in total from the point of beginning till we finally create a viable sperm. So these processes of division are going to be taking place within the testes. The last step is actually not a division process at all. You may not look at these and say these look like real sperm. It's because they're not. They're baby sperm called spermatids. What looks wrong about them?
They don't have
tails. They don't have a tail, yeah. So take these baby sperm, send them to the epidermis, and let them undergo a streamlining process that will get rid of the extra cytoplasm around the nucleus. It allows for us to put a little midpiece there, and you're right, the big deal is that tail. So this very last process is 20 days of the 10-week process. It takes place in the epidermis.
And just like shrink wrap them.
Shrink wrap them, yeah. So they look like little balloons. There we go. Did we change their DNA setup at all?
No.
They're still haploid, right?
Bless you.
Now this last process is called spermiogenesis. It does take place in the epididymis, and we have to accomplish this before the sperm can be ejaculated. So a pretty fancy process. What we end up with in this picture here, on the right side, you'll notice there's a little yellow helmet that's wrapped around the nucleus, which is now called the sperm's head. And that helmet is called an acrosome. The reason that helmet's important is because when the sperm reaches the egg has a pretty tough membrane that must be broken down. So a lot of sperm basically commit suicide by ramming those helmets against the egg. Yeah, they're kamikaze sperm. So of the 200 and some million released in one ejaculation event, lots are lost and killed ramming their heads against the egg's membrane. So in that little helmet there, that yellow helmet that goes around the head, there are enzymes. And those enzymes are supposed to facilitate the breakdown of the female's egg. So we know the story that one sperm should be able to make its way through the membrane. There's a chemical reaction that then happens and prevents further sperm from entering the egg. And of course, if more than one sperm happens to make its way through, quite often that fertilized egg dies and nothing happens further. So that prevents having polyspermy or too many sperm. And you know, in some cases there's even tails such as two or three per sperm. You know, when fertilization occurs, that tail is broken off and left on the outside of the egg. The only important part is the head of the sperm that contains DNA, and that's what actually goes into the egg and creates a new genetic combination. Yep, tail's not important. So if you've got two or three, then you just got a bonus there. All right. How about questions on page 129?
Do you mind going through that like one more time?
Sure.
Just like all on the board?
Okay. So to start the process, we're looking in the testes. These are those tiny tubules in here, those tubules. The spermatogonium is a stem cell, and it's begin the process of making sperm. And this is going to happen from puberty until the very last of a man's life. So the spermatogonium undergoes mitosis. Mitosis simply makes clone cells. They're identical to the parent cell. There's two cells made. One will continue and do this process here. The other one returns back and becomes a stem cell. So let's follow the product of mitosis. It is a primary spermatocyte. It is diploid, and it is a double-stranded set of chromosomes inside. Okay? So that is too many for a sperm to have. Now we have to undergo two divisions. Meiosis one and meiosis two. The goal here is to help strip out the extra DNA. So we go from having our homologous chromosomes pair up in the primary spermatocyte. We separate them into separate cells. So now we've got 23 chromosomes, but they're still double-stranded, and each of these secondary spermatocytes, and I didn't write that there, so let's add that. So these secondary spermatocytes, they're still not ready to be sperm, even though they have 23 chromosomes. What's the problem with those chromosomes? They're double, right? So they're double-stranded. They're not quite ready to fertilize an egg. So we need to pair off some of that excess DNA. Let's undergo another division process here with meiosis II. And that will actually strip apart those double-stranded chromosomes into what?
Single-stranded,
right. So now we finally have haploid and single-stranded chromosomes. That was our goal. And these single-stranded chromosomes now are in the right setup for fertilization. So just to keep track of the chromosomes here, we go from homologous chromosomes, which are 43 double-stranded. We separate them into haploid, but they're still double-stranded. That's still too much. Strip them again. Yep, and then now we've got what?
Haploid
and single-stranded. So that is the goal, is to be haploid and single-stranded. And then one final step, manscapes the sperm, take their extra cytoplasm off, give them a tail, and then they're ready to swim. So that last process actually does not involve any kind of cell reproduction. It's just a streamlining process. Does that help? It's a lot to keep straight here.
And all of that happens in the epididymis, right?
Just this back portion down here, from the top to that point, you could say that is all testes.
Okay.
Technically in the seminiferous tubules.
Okay.
So that's the helper with the helper test here, and then the one down is with the helper epididymis.
Yeah, just this process of sperm tips to sperm is the epididymis. I know we've talked about hormones before. I just want to mention once again, FSH and LH, where are they made?
In the anterior
pituitary.
Hypothalamus.
Hypothalamus tells them to be made, that's right. And in male, FSH travels to the testes and encourages spermatogenesis. LH travels to the testes and encourages testosterone production. Now, in order to make sperm, you're going to require a certain level of testosterone. And in fact, if there's too much testosterone or too many sperm, there's a negative feedback process that's going to reduce the amount that are being made. So inhibin actually carries a negative feedback loop to full circle by shutting off FSH production. So just like its name sounds, inhibin inhibits FSH production. So you may wonder what happens to sperm that are not ejaculated if there's around 250 million sperm made per day. There are lymphatic vessels that carry excess dead sperm from the testes back into the lymphatic system. White blood cells phagocytize those dead sperm, and then they're just carried back in the body's fluids. So that way we don't see an excess of sperm build up in the testes. Okay, so how about questions? Anything here I can review for you? Okay, let's talk about females for just a moment. They're a little more complicated. Always, right?
I don't know. I think it's, this seems more complicated. That's what kind of theory.
I haven't learned it in high school, it's probably been a little complicated. It was a little bit weird back then. I was like, well, how, like, what's the difference between my sisters and my sisters? But now I see them. So we touch on it more detail. So.
And if we had, you know, if we had lots of time, we could go through the every step, anaphase, telophase, all that stuff. But it's, we still get the point across, I think, with this,
mm-hmm.
without having to go into all
this
that.
Is a good summary.
Yeah, summary. Yeah, summary is what it is.
Because it's like, okay, yeah. Well, how do you go from haploid to haploid again? Like, what division's being made there? But
right.
It's
double stranded. That's right.
So that's actually a great song.
You know, females are actually very similar in terms of external genitalia to males. You know, what we look at when we talk about reproductive systems, in a female, we often talk about the inside parts. But the reason that we can't determine if you're carrying a male baby or a female baby until like 12 or 16 weeks of pregnancy is because externally, we both look very similar. The labia majora on a female are actually the same thing as the scrotal tissue on a male. The clitoris on a female is actually the same tissue as the head of the penis on a male. So interesting that we have to wait, you know, a good 2 to 3, 4 months into pregnancy, excuse me, in order to be able to see those parts emerge and to be able to determine a difference. Internally, you know, we don't really look the same, of course, as males. We've got a duct system or a tube system. That's about all the similarity that we've got. But nonetheless, females are a little more complicated in terms of their hormonal control and all the business that goes along with making an egg. Let's see, in this picture, we've got the vagina, which is doubled as a birthing canal. There is a womb here called the uterus. The tip of the womb is called the cervix. These tubes that lead over here toward the ovaries, they're called what?
Fallopian tubes.
Good, fallopian tubes, or you can call them uterine tubes. And the little fimbriae fingers that stick off here, you'll notice don't actually touch the ovary, but rather there are cilia. Yeah, and they're, come here, egg. So, yeah, they're waving, they're creating a peristalsis wave that says, hey, you know, come this way. And I want to make that point because, you know, eggs can drift out into your pelvic cavity, and they can actually be fertilized out there because they emit like a hormonal come here sperm. So sperm can actually follow the egg out into the pelvic cavity and fertilize that egg outside the womb.
Wow.
Yeah. So there have been really rare instances of women having babies to full term, really rare, when the baby's fertilized on the outside of all those parts down there. So there was a woman, I
so
believe.
So what did they attach to?
Yes.
Yeah, I was
going to
say, how did the baby out?
Would have to cut her open.
No, what they're attached to. Like
the outside of the organs. Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God.
Mm-hmm.
I know they've been hospitalized.
How does it get
nutrients?
Yeah, how does it get nutrients? It does
like
the best it can.
Dead.
Yeah.
That's risky.
Oh yeah, definitely could kill the woman.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I say. I'm like, what?
There was a case a few years ago. There was a woman in India who was in her 60s, and she had what she thought was a tumor. You hear about that?
Baby that was like in her stomach for like years.
Yes.
Years. Yeah. It was like a fossilized baby.
Yes.
Inside of her, like mummified.
That's what had happened. So it was outside the birth canal, it was outside the uterus, and it had attached to the outside of her organs. When she was in her 20s, she had labor pains. Her body tried to push out the baby, but it couldn't because it was stuck on the outside of the organs. So basically the baby died, and the body walled it off with calcium, and that was it.
But like, yeah. I'm like, she lived that long?
Yeah.
She was like,
that's usually the baby can kill you from that poison.
Yeah.
I mean, damn, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And not know.
She was a woman. She was living her life.
Right. But they took it out, and I think she's still around. So.
Oh, she's
yeah.
a miracle.
Yeah,
so.
She is.
She definitely is.
But
she
was poisoned.
Yeah.
Oh,
could, and plus, if it ruptured. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It made me wet.
Yeah, it was
an
Indian
No, it was.
Yeah.
Like, I guess it hit the right organ.
Must have, and not the wrong one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Mm. Just wanted to show you this picture. You can see the uterus is wedged between the bladder here and the rectum behind. There are ligaments that hold it into place. That's all. You know, so, of course, if women have a lot of babies, what was it, the 19, 20 kids and counting on TV, the Duggar family. Mm-hmm. Her last baby, she was having problems with her uterus prolapsing or falling out. So, yeah, there's only ligaments holding it.
What?
Yeah, you can have,
yeah.
It can fall out your vagina.
Oh,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure she had bladder issues, too.
I'm sure she did.
Yes.
Yeah. we take a brutal beating.
Holy crap.
I didn't have to teach babies, though.
So,
they can do a...
So, what do they just sew the top of the vagina?
Basically, yeah.
Because I was wondering about that.
They can do a partial, or they can do a full. If they do a full, they cut the ovaries, too.
Okay.
I want to show you a female's oocyte. They're kind of fancy, you know, compared to a sperm. The oocyte comes with her own posse, which is a ring of cells that wraps around the outside, and they're called the corona radiata. And so inside, you'll notice the egg is protected, and this picture has a better view. There's the nucleus of the egg. There's the oocyte, which happens to be the biggest cell in the human body. And this ring of cells around the outside, that's her protective ring of cells. It's called the crown, the radiating crown, or the corona radiata. So, you know, it's not just an oocyte. It's also a follicle of cells that surrounds it. And when a woman starts to produce eggs at puberty, she's actually been carrying these eggs since before she was born. It's only at puberty that she starts to mature, and those cells will blister off the surface of her ovaries, kind of like you see in the picture here. So what I'd like to do is go back to this picture and just parallel the male reproductive pathway so you can see how they're similar. And that's going to come from the bottom of page 135.
All that stuff you just said, I'm not sure if you know what you call the other stuff.
Corona.
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 Does
he or beaches?
great.
Oh my God, that would be so wrong.
I think we'll all be down there.
We're going to have class today.
Everybody be hypo caffeine.
Yeah.
They need to, I mean, seriously, just serve coffee, not donuts.
So females actually start making their oogonia before they're born. In fact, their oogonia undergo mitosis and make primary oocytes. All of that happens before a female is born. And they say that when a female is born, her ovaries contain around 400,000 primary oocytes, and they're stalled here until puberty. So I'll just make a little note that primary oocytes are already present by the time a female baby is born. Starting at puberty, there seems to be a race that occurs in the female's ovaries, and several oocytes are trying to mature at the same time. One of those oocytes, or maybe two, is going to mature to the point of being a secondary oocyte. And each month, that secondary oocyte is blistered off the ovary, like I showed you before. And then, of course, it's going to travel down the fallopian tube where it may be fertilized. Fertilization should occur within about 24 hours of ovulation. Otherwise, what happens to the egg?
It dies.
It dies, yeah. So females have it figured out, okay? So this secondary oocyte is ovulated. You see how far we got? We just made our way to meiosis one, and that's it. And females say, I'm not putting any more time into this unless this egg is fertilized. Ain't wasting my time. If this thing dies, we're done. Ashley.
In our book, there's like, when it breaks, there's a big one and a little one. Is that going to be the big one?
That's going to be the big one. That's right. Because the little one is going to be a polar body. And it cannot be fertilized, it's not big enough, and it's basically a packet of chromosomes that are just discarded. They're not needed for anything. So if this is the end of the story, if this egg is ovulated and not fertilized, game over at this point, we're done. That was easy. Now, the more complicated story comes if fertilization occurs. Where does fertilization occur in a female?
In the fallopian tube. In the angel part.
Yeah, in the angel part. Fertilization may occur within 24 hours of ovulation. Even though these eggs are the biggest cells in the human body, they don't live in about 24 hours. They come packed with nutrients in order to be able to last longer if fertilized. But, you know, 24 hours is about the window of time we get. So let's assume that there is fertilization that occurs here. So we'll say it's both ovulated and fertilized. And I'll put a little sperm nucleus in there. We'll leave the tail on the outside. So what do we need to do in terms of genetics for this egg? Get rid of a second set of chromosomes and undergo meiosis two. So the problem is we are dealing with double-stranded but haploid chromosomes. We need them to be what? Single-stranded. Yeah. So we're haploid, which is good, but we're still double-stranded. So now we're going to undergo meiosis two. We'll reduce our double-stranded chromosome to a single-stranded state. I'm going to leave my sperm there so you can follow him along. And what is this cell called?
Gamete.
It's a gamete. Yeah, it's called an ovum. Good. So that, by the way, is not an egg. That is a single-stranded chromosome.
So does that go off on another polar body?
It will go off on another polar body, yeah.
Goodbye, Mr. Chromosome.
That's right. fertilized, the ovum and the sperm nucleus join and create a new cell that's called a zygote. That zygote will float for around 7 days. That's from day 14 of a female cycle until around day 21. And by day 21, this oocyte, well, now it's an ovum, has been fertilized and has been divided, and it should implant in a female's endometrial lining. So what organ are we in now?
Uterus.
Yeah. If that zygote doesn't find a suitable home when somewhere inside the uterus, then it dies and it drifts out of the female's vaginal fluids. And because we're not yet to day 28, she never knows she was pregnant. So that means that, yeah, that means that we've got 7 days to find a suitable home.
So we were pregnant longer than how many kids would have had? Yes.
And we never know.
And never know.
Yeah.
And that's an issue. I didn't know I was pregnant.
Oh, Lord, I don't understand how they didn't know they were crazy.
And not feel anything, yeah.
That the baby will kill you. It's moving.
Speaking of cycle, I just wanted to give you a look at page 138 in this menstrual ovarian cycle. There's details on pages 136 and 137, but I think it's easier to look at the picture. So on average, how long is a typical female's cycle? Not period, but cycle. 28 days, right. And they say that's average because even for one female, that may be 1 month, the next month varies, and so forth. So on average, 28 days is what we see as a typical cycle. There's two cycles here on this picture. There's actually an ovarian cycle that follows the ovaries, and there's a cycle that also that follows the uterus. Let me tell you, the uterus is basically mindless, and it does everything the ovaries tell it to do. So the ovaries run the show here. They're the ones that release hormones, and those hormones tell the uterus, this is what you're going to do. So it's interesting because years later after menopause, they can actually reactivate a female's uterus, and a woman in her 70s could still give birth. The uterus never dies. It's the ovaries that stop making hormones around the time of menopause. Average age of menopause is something like 51 years old. So let's start with day zero here. They say that that is the menstrual phase. That's when we have basically a period. What happens to the uterus when a female has a period?
It sloughs off.
Yeah, sloughs off, is shed. And notice what's happening with the hormone levels. All the hormones during a female's period are very low. Yeah. And notice the ovaries. The ovaries are not yet ready to make an oocyte, so they're getting ready for it.
That's why
I didn't. Yeah, everything is shut down during those days of the menstrual cycle. After the period, you'll notice that we enter a phase called the proliferative phase. That's around day 5 to 14 on this cycle. And during that time period, notice what happens to the endometrial lining. It begins to thicken. Notice also what happens to the hormone levels. Starts to increase. Good. Day 14, though, is a special day because that is the day that ovulation occurs.
That's the dangerous day.
That's the dangerous day. That's right. Day to avoid. If you want to avoid certain...
Stay away from me.
Yeah. So what happens, what kind of cell is released on day 14? Secondary.
Okay.
Yep. Secondary oocyte is ovulated or released from the egg, or from the ovary, rather. It comes with its ring of cells, you know, that corona radiated, and you'll notice that is going to be part of our story starting here at ovulation. So how long does that oocyte live? 24 hours, and if it's fertilized, it has a chance to live 7 more days as it floats to the uterus. And so a female's body doesn't know whether or not fertilization has occurred. So after day 14, we're in what's called the secretory phase until day 28. What is the body pretending is going to happen?
You're
going to
be pregnant.
You're going to be pregnant, right. So for the next 2 weeks after ovulation, your body is playing, let's keep house, let's build up the endometrial lining. But notice what happens to the hormone levels. FSH and LH drop, you're right. And which one maintains a high level?
Progesterone.
Yeah, so progesterone is high during the second half after ovulation. Notice progesterone is very low during the first half. You know those PMS symptoms you get?
Yeah, so that's why you get that
The breast nerve.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So when progesterone drops, when this oocyte and its follicle are finally dead and gone, the hormone levels bottom out, then you feel all crampy and you feel moody
pissed
and whatever.
Off.
Pissed
yeah,
off.
Like,
yeah.
Get away.
That is because of progesterone and estrogen levels.
Just don't mess with me today.
That's right.
Yeah.